And welcome to another edition of Book Talk. I'm Stephen Ussery, and I'm happy to welcome Michael Ferris Smith back to the program today. Michael is the author of four novels, The Hands of Strangers, Rivers, and Desperation Road. Little Brown has recently published the fourth, The Fighter, which is the story of a broken-down bare-knuckle boxer who heads back to the Mississippi Delta to answer for his past. The Fighter starts off with a flashback to the early 70s, and a very young boy is dropped off at a Salvation Army shop, and he seems very self-possessed for his age.
Yeah, I suppose so. I don't know, sometimes you don't have a choice at any age, and I think, you know, kids pick up on things so quickly. You know, they're so much more cognitive than we think they are, and so much more, I think, even resilient than we think they are. And some kids have to deal with a lot. He's one of those kids, you know. I think he learns to be tough by necessity, obviously very early, and it's something that never leaves him, you know, never leaves him.
Yeah, I think he had already known he wasn't getting attention from his real parents. So
yeah, it's weird. It feels like a relief, you know, in some ways, that moment. But, you know, it's just the beginning of, you know, what's going to be probably a tough childhood.
Now, then when the book begins in earnest, round one, as you can call it in the book, over 40 years later, and Jack Boucher is running on fumes at this point in his life.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I kind of like that movement from you meet him as a child, from that moment of abandonment to really becoming very distrustful of the world already by the time he comes to live with Mary Ann at age 12. And then that skip to him, you know, 35, 40 years later. And he's right, he is running on fumes. And that's just the way I imagined him when I thought of, I mean, he was what I started the novel with, just this idea of Jack Boucher, this busted up cage fighter, and all the problems he might have, the physical pain, and how would he cope with the physical pain by deadening it with pills, and then you've got the chance of a pill addiction. I mean, the opioid problem is so huge in this country right now. And then what would come from, you know, the concussions that he would sustain over the years, where, you know, you don't necessarily think you have a concussion or know or care. It's a headache to you, and you just keep going and keep fighting. And
but that CTE is just eating away at it.
Yeah, and that had an influence, too, all the NFL stuff. I was paying attention to that and all the studies and all. And so I thought, you know, here's a guy, he's going to have a ton of issues. So running on fumes is a good way to put it when we meet him.
I have to say, I've given up on contact sports.
Yeah.
Football, combat sports.
Yeah.
I just can't watch these guys throw their lives away like that anymore.
I know. I'm very happy. I've said this to several of my friends and who have this decision to make later because they have sons, but I'm glad I have two daughters and I don't have to make the football decision because I love football and played it and watch it all the time, but I don't know that I would want my kid out there engaged with it, and it'd be a tough call to have a kid who really wants to play and, you know, have to tell them no. That or either let them play and then have to sit and watch and be very scared of what could happen.
I've heard even heading the ball in soccer
can
cause concussions now.
That makes sense. The ball comes in pretty hard, and I think those players knock heads quite a bit too going up for the same ball.
Or knee to head.
That's right.
Did you ever get your bell rung?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, but we didn't. You know, back when I played, it was, you know, slap you on the back, go get some water, get back in there. I mean,
shake it off.
Yeah, exactly. And I think it was that way pretty much across the board and on any level, which has led to so much deterioration from people who, like, played extended through that time. But, yeah, it was a headache, you know. And you're right. Like you said, you got your bell rung, you know, go shake it off and get back in there. And you didn't think twice about it. And if you couldn't remember the next day what the score was or maybe who you played, it was just kind of funny, you know. You didn't think about it much longer than that.
Have you ever seen one of these bare-knuckle bouts in person?
In person, no. I mean, unless you count the brawls I've, you know, been aside in parking lots or bars or, you know, a fight or two I may have gotten in myself, like a lot of South Mississippi boys get in. But in terms of, like, something so organized with, like, people passing bills around betting on the moment, no. But I've been close to a few really good fights, sanctioned or not.
I'm happy you haven't thrown a fist in anger since high school.
That's good. That's very good. Yeah, I know I haven't. I've thought about it many times, but time changes.
One of the reasons he's running on fumes, he owes a lot of money to someone who's bigger than life, Big Mama Sweet.
And I had a lot of fun with Big Mama Sweet, you know, when I thought of what kind of person would he owe out in the Delta. And I didn't even know who she was. When I was writing that opening piece, when I just said he's driving to the Delta and he's got that note written to himself, 12,000 straight to Big Mama Sweet. Like, when I wrote Big Mama Sweet, I had no idea who she was, but I thought, oh my God, what a great name. And who is that going to be? So creating her was just so much fun. I really tried to let my imagination go with the kind of place she would have set up really out in the Blacklands of the Delta and kind of the power she would have and the muscle she would have, you know, and the history of manipulating and people and of providing people what they wanted for the right price, that type thing. She was a lot of fun to write. I didn't know what was going to come out of her mouth and I didn't know what she might do. And to me, those are always the most fun characters when even you aren't quite sure what they're going to do.
Now, your couple books previous have been set down further in the South, closer to the Gulf, and then on the Louisiana-Mississippi line. What was it like for you writing about the Delta this time around?
It was cool. It was good for me to, I think, use a different landscape. I've spent some time over in the Delta the past few years, getting to know people over there and being back and forth in and out of there quite a bit, and just listening to the way, you know, people over there, you know, talk about the place and the way they are, and then the landscape of it, too. You know when you're in the Delta. You come down the final hill, whichever direction you come from, and all of a sudden it just flattens out, and it's just, it can be really beautiful. But the Delta is so complex. I really enjoyed using it. I enjoyed writing about a different part of Mississippi. There's so many different parts of Mississippi, and I think there's different voices in each of these parts, too. And I think to keep novel writing exciting for me and you know, interesting for me, I need to, you know, keep using different places. And that was part of it, too. But as soon as I had Jack and I knew kind of what kind of trouble he was in, I thought, this is your chance to use the Delta right here. I can't think of a better place for him to be from or be heading back into with, you know, such risk.
You've and your family have moved up to Oxford, Mississippi, here in the past couple of years. What was that move all about?
It was move really for, you know, a lot of people, you know, may think it was just for me wanting to be in Oxford around, you know, more of a literary community, but it was really for the whole family. I also, too, I think change of scenery is good every now and then. That kind of goes back to my own history of moving around a lot as a preacher's kid and then becoming kind of restless, I think, at an early age with the constant moving or a lot of shifting around. And then in a young adulthood, I did the same thing. I was never in one place for long.
Yeah, you went over to Europe for a while, didn't you?
Yeah, I lived in Europe, you know, lived in different parts of the country, even just if just for months at a time, you know, just to be kind of somewhere different. And, you know, Europe really opened my eyes. I loved all the different places there. And my wife and I, before we had children, we never stayed in one place. I think 2 or 3 years was the longest, you know, we were anywhere. So we were in Columbus for 10 years and really enjoyed it. It's a great little community, had a lot of friends, but just a change of scenery was good. You know, over the years, kind of like with the Delta, me getting to know people over there and being in and out, I've made a lot of friends in Oxford, you know, with the books and stuff like that. And so, yeah, time was just right and seemed to fit for all of us. It's been a good move.
Think you can do 10 years there?
I don't know. We'll see. Possibly. You know, it's 10 years till I have a 7th grader and a 1st grader, so I think if I tried to move my 7th grader again before she graduates high school, which I guess is another 6, she would lose it on me, but I don't know. We'll see. You never know. I still dream of, you know, having a place in Paris at some point, but that's a pretty big move.
Maybe Paris, Tennessee.
Maybe not.
Well, with that peripatetic life you've lived, do you think that informed how Jack's character turned out with him moving around so much on the fight circuit?
Yeah, I do. And I've said this to my wife early on in writing The Fighter. And then particularly as I kind of drove through that manuscript, I said to her, I can't really put my finger on it, but I think I feel maybe more emotionally attached to Jack than I have any other character I've written. And it's nothing biographical, I think, because of the, you know, issues he has and all the fighting and this and that and the other. And but it, I think his sense of longing and his really kind of just kind of always just wondering kind of where he belongs and where he's from and that type of thing. Particularly that last scene when he and Marianne there at the end and he's asking her kind of what she's looking for out on the horizon. I think that's probably about as close, as personal a passage as I could have written. So, yeah, I think there's a lot of me in Jack Boucher, you know. I don't think it's necessarily has to do with his aches and pains and his fists, but just the way he is, maybe. I felt really kind of close to him throughout that novel.
At one point, he is thinking about his childhood and that he'll never know who his parents were and where he came from and what led up to that decision for them to drop him off. So when you're thinking about that character and trying to think about developing him, when you have a void that even he can't access, I mean, how does that affect you in developing his character? I mean, do you know what his parents were like?
No, I don't. I don't. I mean, I purposefully didn't try to find them, you know, either in my mind or just in general. I thought the void was a part of Jack from the beginning, and I didn't want to try to, you know, answer it or fill it in any way. I mean, I think that void is part of what drives him to become what he's become. And I think it's also part of what makes him finally realize, I have got to get back and I've got to see Marianne and I've got to take care of this. You know, I have betrayed her in every way possible, but she's the only one. You know, he's got all these questions, no answers really about, you know, who his parents were or what they were like or how he came to be or if he has brothers and sisters anywhere or whatever. But through all his struggles and problems, things that have come upon him and things that he's brought upon himself, I think he's finally realizing that Marianne has been it for you. For all these questions you have, she's the one concrete thing, that one relationship, that one person who loved you, and you need to go take care of it if you still can, you know.
And I think it's a bit different from your two previous novels in Rivers and Desperation Road, in which, you know, a lot of the main characters were suffering from reduced circumstances. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the folks in this novel never had circumstances to be reduced from.
Yeah, you know, when I imagine Jack, I kind of thought this guy's, like, pretty extreme. When I thought of Big Mama Sweet, I thought she's going to be pretty extreme, too. You know, extreme but believable. And then I just kind of adopted that philosophy for everybody who walked into that novel. You know, Annette, shares many of the characteristics that Jack does and many of the same questions, at least, that he shares. And Marianne, too. I thought creating this character who has never been anywhere, you know, the opposite of Jack in that terms of the restlessness, she kind of has this place in Clarksdale that she's never left. But there's reasons, you know, why she hasn't left. And so she's got her own great questions and her own void also. I wanted them all to be really stretched out, you know, as far as I could stretch them while keeping them in the realm of reality and possibility, too.
Tell us about Annette and how you introduce her in the book. She's in her early mid-20s, came to Memphis, and she has her own ideas about the world.
Yeah, I think what I really liked about Annette is she's independent and she's strong, but she's also, like, very curious about who she is. And, like, she doesn't know who her father is. And so she develops this, her own theology, calls it the Church of Coincidence. And she's looking for something, but she doesn't really know what, but she's looking so hard. She's looking for signs and this or that and the other, you know, the billboard that leads her to, you know, becoming a stripper for a short time. And then
those omens and portents.
That's right. And then leaving that just in the spur of the moment because she had seen some sign to something else, and then coming upon the carnival and just seeing that as it's like she's really searching for these things in her life that are going to answer her questions, but she doesn't even really know what the questions are. So she develops this Church of Coincidence to give her some type of foothold, I guess. I think a lot of us do that. I think we have a tendency, or I have a tendency, I can't speak for everybody, obviously, to kind of look for signs sometimes, or at least see things as signs to help drive us forward when things maybe aren't going so well, or to give us confidence, or to make us just feel that, you know what, everything's going to be all right. And that's kind of the thing that Annette lives by. Like, and she's really dedicated to it, and she sits and waits on that next big thing. And that made her very unique to me, and it made her her own character. You know, she's got her questions, she's got her void, but she's got this tangible thing that at least it's tangible to her, you know, this thing she's created. People all have their own interpretations of religion. It doesn't matter, you know, if you sit by the same person in church for 50 years straight, you know, in your mind and in your spirit, you both are going to have different interpretations. So she's got this thing she's just holding on to, and I loved it. I loved going into her head, and I loved her looking and then seeing something and trying to put it together.
What drives her to get the tattoos, and what does she think she's getting out of the tattoos?
I don't know. That's a good question. To me, she's the kind of person that once she starts, she kind of can't stop. And she has these kind of, well, I won't say she can't stop, because she has these bursts of experiences. Like, she gets the tattoo and she starts living with the tattoo artist. And so it just becomes a snowball, you know, to where her body becomes this walking exhibit, I think is how it's described. But then she tires of it. You know, and she's gone. And then she sees the billboard for the Gentleman's Club in Memphis, and she goes and does that. And then she tires of it and then just drops it, like just walks out. And then she comes upon, you know, the carnival months later, and, hey, I've got an idea. I'll be the tattoo lady. And just bam. So I don't know that she has an addictive personality, but she obviously is very impulsive and has a tendency to go all the way maybe when something grabs her. So I guess that would be the best way to describe it. And I think, too, she just likes the way maybe they look on this body of hers, you know. She's very prideful of how she looks.
That dichotomy of she is so reserved and giving of her own personal self to other people, but she's out there for exhibition.
Yeah. You always hear about people who are entertainers or musicians or even writers or whatever who do go on stage and do present themselves, and their life is largely in the public. But when you get them off of that, how reserved and private they can be. And I've always thought how interesting that is. To you essentially have two lives, one where you're up in front of people and representing this thing, and then the other where you just really want to be left alone, but you can't separate the two, because one is giving you the opportunity to be the other. And she is. When she's on the stage, she likes people looking at her, but she doesn't necessarily want anybody getting close to her. And I think when she does have that quiet time, when she gets to know Baron, and then later when she's drawn to Jack, she, you know, this possibility for personal connection seems to be really strong, or the hope for personal connection becomes really strong when she finds some type of camaraderie in another person.
Well, what's it like for you doing interviews like this after you've sat in your office for a year and a half or two writing a book and then have it go out and answer to it in public?
It's interesting. And I kind of go back and forth on my attitude about it. Like, I will say it's been different for this one, because I said to my wife again, like I've already mentioned, how personal I think Jack was to me and this novel was to me on many different levels. You know, I told her, I said, you know, I know how I feel about it. I'm a little nervous about starting to talk about it, because I don't know if that'll change it for me, you know, when you start to share and talk about it with other people. But, you know, the other thing is, it doesn't matter how many events you do, how many people you talk to about a particular novel or story, you're going to get a new question, or you're going to get something new every single time, which is kind of amazing to me. And to me, that's the thing that's really cool about it, is you're then kind of reminded of what the reading experience is like, and even the creation process and all this, and how you see things, you know, your way, and you experience it. But then when the book is done, it belongs to whoever is reading it then. It's not really yours anymore, and people are going to bring their own interpretations to it. And I'm always interested in hearing, you know, what those are. And so, yeah, I like radio interviews. I like these a lot better than some other things, but I like sitting here and talking on the radio.
Let me get into one of these little interpretations of mine then, right now. You have Annette getting the tattoos, and you also have Jack being marked by scars from battle. Then you've got two other characters who don't receive marks but they impose marks. Mm-hmm. And you have Big Mama Sweet, who brands a dollar sign on people's necks to say they owe her money. And then you have Mary Ann, who is a potter in her younger life, and she puts her initials on the bottom of the pots. Mm-hmm. So you have those who are marked and those who do the marking and the different motivations for each of those.
See, that's what I'm talking about right now. Like, I've not thought, I've obviously would have thought of Big Mama Sweet, but you mentioning Mary Ann marking the pottery, like, it's just something I haven't really thought about. What was the question?
Well, just that there are those who are marked and those who do the marking.
Right. I mean, if you wanted to get big and metaphorical, you know, that's kind of the way things are. And I think we see that a lot. I mean, people talk about me writing about the underdog and the downtrodden, you know, but there's a lot of underdogs and there's a lot of downtrodden out there. I mean, you could call it the haves and the have-nots or whatever you want to call it, but, you know, it seems like those who get marked and those who do the marking, you know, it's, you know, we'd say it's a power balance, but in the novel it's not really, because Annette chooses to be. Jack is, I guess he's choosing to be too, because he's fought.
It's a consequence of his life.
That's right. It's the consequences of his life. And he's delivered, you know, blows and scars too, and he's been responsible. I don't know that I have a good answer for that. I haven't really thought about it. I think the thing about Mary Ann is interesting, because I think she actually explains to Jack, if I'm not mistaken, mm-hmm. when he's a boy, about the pottery and about her putting her mark on it so that people, when they have it, your mark is always going to be there forever, because she's trying to teach him about life and she's just trying to teach him about being normal, I think, and about, I think in some ways she's trying to teach him about family and relationship in that lesson without saying to Jack, hey, if you love someone, you can always love someone. It'll always be there, which I think is what she's really trying to impart to him. Which, so when she's talking about this thing she does with her hands that she loves and she marks it so that people know it belongs to her, I think maybe that in some ways her trying to teach Jack some type of lesson as a child. Lessons in acceptance and the freedom of loving someone or allowing someone to love you that he hasn't known before.
Because of who she wasn't going to have children of her own. Mm-hmm. And that's a bid for immortality in its way.
Yeah, it is. You know, I think that's one of the cool things about doing anything artistic or creative. It's once it's out there, you know, it's going to be there, you know. And you can be as simple as someone who creates pottery on the weekend, you know. And once you do it and you mark it, it's yours and it's there and it's always going to be. It's a way of, you know, participating in the world or leaving your mark. There's that word again, or a little bit piece of the world, which I think we all kind of want to do. You know, I think in some ways we'd all like to be, feel like we're leaving something, you know, whatever that may be. And it's possible, you know, everybody can do it. You know?
Big Mama Sweet, she's not looking for immortality. She's looking for all she can get right now. And she knows that providing to people's wants, yeah, is the way to get it and power over them.
She has that figured out for sure. And she does. You're right. She is about right now. This is what I gave you, and this is your day to give it back to me. And if you haven't, then this is what you get. She's pretty hardcore. You know, she's all about the party. She's all about, you know, the vice. If you want it, tell me. I'll get it for you, that type thing. She's not after immortality. But yet, I think she's probably attained it. You know, she's the kind of person who people will always be talking about her. She will become legend, and, you know, 100 years from now,
she's the thing that goes bump in the night.
That's right. People will still tell stories about Big Mama Sweet and what she did to my grandpa or uncle or whoever. But she's unconcerned with that in the moment. She's concerned about, what can you do for me since you don't have my money? Or do you have my money? And if you have some more money, what would you like to do while you're here?
Now, there are a couple of smaller characters who seem like they could be brothers from other mothers. And that's the tweaker, Skelly,
yeah,
who Jack runs across at the beginning of the book, and Ricky Joe, who's part of the carnival later on.
Yeah, well, you know, to me, those are just the kind of guys you might run across in the middle of the night. You know, one in the middle of the Delta, and then two, work in some type of outlaw carnival, you know, because there's nothing clean and fair about this carnival. It's the outlaw carnival, you know, and it's pretty rickety and, you know, the filled up by ex-cons and guys on parole and this and that and other. I think any character you create, and I've learned this over the years, whether it be a major character or somebody who's just coming in and out, they've got to do something, and I think they've got to amp up the tension. And Skelly and Ricky Joe did that for me. They were opportunities to raise the stakes, you know, in the very immediate, too. And I wanted to create them. I've learned also that it doesn't matter who walks into the novel, you've got to create them as a real person. You know, there's no such thing as a secondary character who just can be forgettable. You know, I want the secondary characters to be as memorable as everyone else. And I like those secondary characters, you know. I could probably think of many throughout the last three, you know, my work. And they, a lot of times they're the funnest ones for me to write, just kind of like the woman at the gas station who comes out in the camouflage, who recognizes Jack. She was a pleasure, you know, to put onto the page. But yeah, I would agree that Skelly and Ricky Joe are probably brothers from, like you said. But yeah, they did what needs to be done in a novel, and that they pushed the tension forward and they raised the stakes and they made things more difficult.
And someone who made Jack's life more difficult, you mentioned his name earlier, was Baron.
Yeah.
He didn't know he was doing it. He's the guy that runs the Outlaw Carnival. But he has a certain zen about him, and he is comfortable with the problems he has, mm-hmm. and he does not want new problems.
I like that about Baron, and maybe that was a chance for me to ease off the pedal a little bit, whereas every, you know, so many other characters just driving and driven right through. You know, I liked that Baron sits down in the lawn chair in the evening. And like you said, he knows what his problems are and he's comfortable with them, but he doesn't want any more. And that he sits there and he smokes a cigarette and maybe pops open a beer and watches the stars come out, you know. And in those moments when he spoke to Annette about his youth and his adulthood and the things that he had gone through, the things surrounding when he left his, walked off the farm in Arkansas, you know, a long time ago. There was kind of a settling nature for Baron that I think helped me through it too. A normalcy, I guess he's the closest thing to probably normal that there is in the novel. And I like that moment, kind of in Desperation Road with the father who has the farm that Russell goes out to. And when Russell's out there, his problems seem to kind of dissipate, you know, because you got the pond and you got the moonlight and you just got that tranquility. And for Baron, that character for me and those moments for me, and which gave Annette the same thing too, these moments of everything's okay, let's just sit here and enjoy where we are right now.
But he was almost the other side of the coin for Marianne, because right. She stayed home to her detriment where Baron left.
That's true. And he is a true rambler. You know, he truly lives out of his suburban and lives with the carnival moving around from place to place and setting up wherever they can set up, you know, minus permits and whatever else you might need. He is very much different from Marianne, kind of settled in his age and with time and kind of understanding this moving thing is where he belongs and this is the life that's right for him, but very comfortable, very much like Marianne was in some ways comfortable where she was. To the point to where it kept her from being who she really wanted to be, I think.
But with Annette, he was willing to give her the money they found, but he said, just don't leave.
Yeah, just don't leave. That was one of those lines that just popped out for me, too. Like when he said it, I thought, what a lovely thing for him to say to her, because they have developed this relationship. She's different than anybody else he has there, and she's, you know, apparently different than anybody else he's had around for a while. She's not a problem. She's something that pacifies him, something that I think he feels a little peace in their relationship. So when he gives her the money, I mean, when you live the kind of life he lives, you know, money and a lot of money is a ticket. People don't stick around, you know. So I think he knows when he gives her the money that what's going to happen, which is both kind of sweet that he gives it to her, and then sad, too. It's almost like he knows he's letting go. You know, he knows she's going to be gone, but he tells her, don't leave. And I really like that he said that to her. I think it spoke a lot about their relationship without having to say too much else.
Well, and it was so kind to say to her, here's the money. You don't have to steal it from me.
Right.
It's right here.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, I like that too. Like I said, you know, some sense of being normal in a very chaotic lifestyle, where he's really honestly concerned that any of his, you know, carnival workers might rob him at any moment, or, you know, and they probably have, and, you know, God knows they run out on him left and right, and then he picks up somebody else he doesn't really trust. And but with her, there is a sweetness there, and it's almost like he's reaching out to her. He can't decide if that move is going to make her stay or help her leave, you know, but he just does it.
Your works deal with folks at the margins.
Yeah.
Have you ever thought about putting someone that's a little bit more comfortable in a difficult situation than these folks who are already suffering?
No, I haven't. I don't know. I just, there's something to me about being on the margin. And I think a lot of people live on the margin. That you don't necessarily have to be walking down the side of the road to be on the margin, you know. It's all around. But I'm really interested in people who, like, I mean, like, day to day, they have to make really tough decisions, you know. And when you throw in comfort, that takes that away, at least on some level, you know.
But then taking the comfort away from them.
Yeah.
For the driving the action of a novel.
Right. I don't know. I have not really thought about it. Maybe it'll happen eventually, but I don't know.
Just that phrase had run through my head earlier today, that art is to comfort the afflicted and to afflict the comfortable.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. I don't know, man. There's just something about immediate anxiety. And the thing, when I learned this, that's worked for me in my novels, is that when I started writing novels, this happened with Rivers, it happened with Desperation Road. It didn't happen so much with The Fighter, but because I think I learned. Is that what have things happening 30, 40, 50 pages down the road that it was taking a while to get to? And perhaps I was establishing some type of comfort, you know, in those first 30, 40, 50 pages. And then when I would take that thing on page 50 and put it on page 15 or page 12, it really changed the dynamic of the novel. So maybe that's one reason that I've... You maybe don't get to feel that comfort, because maybe I write it, but then I take it right out. You know, I take it out.
Do you think in any sense that writing about these folks on the margins, is there like a sense of guilt in you, the there but for the grace of God go I type thing?
I don't know. I think I feel guilt over, like, and I was talking to somebody about this last night, feeling, you know, once you become privy and aware of all the kind of hurt and struggle that's around you, you feel really dumb moaning to yourself about your problems, you know. My wife is a social worker, and I've been part of that world with her and just see the types of things she deals with and how many children are out there that just, I mean, like a lot like Jack, are just dropped off, and just they don't have one person in the entire world, not one. And then when I'm, you know, aggravated because I have to, you know, I have a flat tire, or just what we all worry and stress over things and feel sorry for ourselves at particular times. And then I think the guilt I feel sometimes is realizing how small my problems are in comparison to so many other people. In terms of like what I'm writing about, if it's kind of a sense of relief or guilt or whatever, I would say no. I mean, it's just a sense of creating people that I'm really interested in and that I love and that I'm really pulling for to come through.
You recently just got back from a trip to Australia.
Yeah.
What was that like?
Man, it was great. It was a haul to get there. And I never really knew what day it was or what time it was while I was there. Because you travel for 2 days, and then you're there for 5, and then you travel for 2 more. So, like, I left, and I was pretty much in an airport or in an airplane for 24 hours. And then it's 17 hours ahead when you get there. So I lost 2 days. But I was in Adelaide, which was South Australia, and they have this wonderful writers, they call it Writers Week, and it's probably, I think they said it's 40 or 50 years old, and they have it in a beautiful park there, and they have big crowds. I mean, it's a first-class event, and there's writers from all over the world there. It was very rewarding and very interesting to honestly be halfway around the world and have someone walk up to you and say, I really enjoy your work, or I'm a fan of your work. You know, that happens here and in the South and around. I bump into people, but at the end of the day over there, you know, after I'd, you know, done an interview or been in front of a crowd, to kind of go back to my hotel and realize, man, you are on the flip side here, And it's really kind of rewarding, you know. It was very rewarding and humbling and flattering. And it was a great city, great people running the event. So many kind of just very laid back and cool people I met on the way. I was very flattered to be invited.
Did you run into Thomas Mullen while you were there?
Yeah, he and I actually did my first event. He and I did a panel together called The American South. And then a couple of days later, I did the one-on-one thing, and then so did he. But he and I started out together and hung out and had dinner. He's a good dude. And I enjoy his work, too.
Yeah, his books are something else.
Yeah.
Well, you got anything else you're working on right now?
I have been fortunate to have an idea I really like that I started on last year, and I was hustling, trying to get a draft of it done before the Australia trip, because back from Australia, now the fighter's coming out, and I actually go to France the first week of April, too, so the next few months are lost. And I did. I turned in a novel about mid-February called Blackwood that I like quite a bit. So I can kind of just enjoy what's happening right now without having that story in the back of my mind and trying to feeling guilty over not working. Now I can just go and enjoy what's up. So it would be next fall, so.
How much more work does it have to have on it?
I don't know. I've only had a brief conversation with my editor about it, but I'll spend this summer whipping it into shape and get it ready. It's cool. It's a little bit different for me. The thing I'm kind of proud of with all of my novels is, you know, my DNA is in all of them, but I think you can have different conversations about each of them. And I think Blackwood is the same way. Kind of my notion for it was this guy who's staring out at this kudzu-covered valley, and he's kind of going a little crazy looking at it and thinking about it. And so I went from there, and I kind of thought about what if The Shining was set in Mississippi in a kudzu-covered valley, and kind of went from there. Maybe a little spookier and that type thing, a little bit different from what I've done before. Still, obviously, my DNA, but it was fun. Again, it's fun for me to try to write it. Something a little different, you know, something that keeps me interested. So that's what Blackwood is. And I'll spend the rest of the year getting it shaped up, but that'll be next fall.
Well, I want to thank you so much for stopping by, and we're looking forward to Blackwood next year.
Yeah, well, thank you. It's always good to come by.
Michael Ferris Smith is the author of The Fighter, which is published by Little Brown. I'm Stephen Usry, and this is Book Talk.
Thank you for joining us today. Book Talk is produced in the studios of FM 89.3 WYPL Memphis, a service of the Memphis Public Library, a division of the City of Memphis. Book Talk is copyrighted by the Memphis Public Library, all rights reserved.